I'm going to read a short passage, or just a couple verses, really. God, who at various times and various ways spoke in time past to the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by His Son, whom He has appointed heir of all things, through whom also He made the world, He made the worlds, who being the brightness of His glory and the express image of His person, and upholding all things by the word of His power, when He had by Himself purged our sins, sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high, having become so much better than the angels, as He has by inheritance obtained a more excellent name than they. We're going to be taking a look at the book of Revelation over the next couple months. And as this slide says, it's the first phrase that we come across in the book of Revelation. And if you're going to title the book, that's probably the best one that we have is the Revelation of Jesus Christ. A few years ago, actually close to a decade ago, I gave a talk called Babylon, the City of Rebellion. And in that lesson, I said that if you were to choose an alternate name for the Bible, you might call it A Tale of Two Cities. The cities of Cain / Babylon versus the city of God / Jerusalem. And that's doubly true of the book of Revelation. You could call it A Tale of Two Cities, being Babylon and New Jerusalem. Over the next 8 weeks, just to give us an idea of how this study is going to be conducted, this week we're going to look at the why, what, and when of the book, Revelation's place in the history and canon. I'm going to try to give you as much information pertinent to that as possible with the time available. Next week, hopefully, we'll do symbolism and numbers in the Old Testament, those being the keys to understanding the book, at least as far as my interpretation of it goes. And we'll also at least begin an overview of the interpretation of the book since John's time. As I got looking into that, that's an incredibly huge topic, and it seems like we could literally spend weeks and weeks on that. We will probably spend at least into the third week on that. As I've studied it, and I talked with Gerald about what this class was supposed to be, I think that might be as useful. Week two and three might be as useful as anything else we do together over the course of these 8 weeks. And then from week three on, roughly, through week eight, I'm going to give you what I call the historicist interpretation of Revelation. We'll only be looking at chapter 6 through 22 when we get to that part. We will take a look at several other views when it's appropriate, mostly in the overview of the interpretation. That's an interesting history itself, why those interpretations, alternate interpretations, came up with. One of the strengths of the historicist or historical interpretation is that it's actually the earliest, and I plan on giving you the information that proves that. So that's what the next 8 weeks are going to look like. We are going to, once we get to starting to interpret the symbols with the first seal in chapter 6, we will be skating through very, very fast. We'll skate through all of the signs, so we will do an interpretation of all the signs in the book, but I'm not going to burden you with a whole lot of history lectures. We will, however, slow down and delve deeper once we get to chapter 10, particularly when we get to chapter 12, 13, and 14. I've always viewed those as kind of, if not really the point of the book, perhaps the most critical part to understand, at least as far as my understanding of the book goes. So we'll spend a good deal of time on those chapters and talking about the Antichrist and the man of sin, using other passages in both the Old Testament and in the New Testament. As part of this study, we'll also do a side-by-side comparison with Daniel in particular, but also we'll take a look at Ezekiel and Zechariah, probably less time on those two books. So once we do start popping the seals, I'll give you an idea. Once we pop the first seals, I'll probably do the seven seals and the first six trumpets in one session. And that's moving pretty fast. And the way it'll work is, because we've talked about symbolism, I'll just be able to show it what I think the fulfillment of that sign is. And then I'll also point out, and this came to my attention about a month ago, I think it was at a two-week meeting a few years ago, Rick Sparks did 10 sessions on Revelation, and Rick and I listened to all 10 of them. Rick and I's are about 95% similar, especially on those parts of the book. So if you want, he spends a lot more time on those parts of the book. So if you want to, I would YouTube that. Although if you YouTube Rick Sparks, you'll find out that there's a piano player named Rick Sparks who's actually quite good. He records like easy listening music. So if you search Pleasant Hill Rick Sparks Revelation on YouTube, you'll come across that pretty easily. It's very good. So there is that available, and I'll also give you some other sources as we go through this as well. So, why was the revelation sent? Well, Revelation 1:3 says, "Blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keep those things which are written in it, for the time is near." We were at Stephen Gaynor's about a little over a month ago talking about this class. And I went through a period. I taught this book four times in about a two-year stretch. And I read the New Testament every year, but I've gotten in the habit over the last decade of reading Matthew through the New Testament, 1 John, 2 John, Jude, flipping back to Matthew and starting to read again. I was totally avoiding the book of Revelation, and I actually avoided it until Gerald and I talked about this class last summer. And since then, I've read it about a dozen times. And it's interesting. I don't know why I avoided it, because it is a book that does pump me up. And I think that may be part of the point of the book. There is a lot of unpleasantness in the book of Revelation. That's a book about history, and the history of, by and large, a fallen world. And there's a lot of unpleasant things that men do to one another in this world, and that stuff can't be avoided when we're talking about history. But it is a book of victory for those who are with Jesus. Regardless of the interpretation, whether we're talking about the historicist, the preterist, the futurist, or the idealist, they all have one thing in common, and that is that they all agree that in the end, these will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. That's Revelation 17:14. Maybe it was pointed out to me about 20-some years ago that might be the most important verse in the entire book. And after having read this book many, many times and studying it in depth quite a bit, I've held to that as well. That's perhaps the most important verse in the entire book. War on Christ is a losing proposition. And so if you place yourself, if you do what you need to do in this life to make your call and election sure, then you will stand with him in victory, and his glory will be shared with you. And that's really the point. The book points out here is the patience or endurance of the saints. Several times early in the chapters, as we went through the overview of the letters in the Revelation, he who overcomes, he who overcomes, he who overcomes. So it's a book given to Christians who were being persecuted, and it was an effort by Jesus to give them hope that no matter how bad it gets here, he's going to pull out the victory in the end, no matter how rough it looks. Christ wins, and we will share his victory and his glory. One of the things that it's always done for me as well is it draws a clear distinction that I think is extremely critical. As I just mentioned, to Ephesus, to him who overcomes will be given the right to eat of the tree of life. To Smyrna, in chapter 2, verse 11, he who overcomes shall not be hurt by the second death. The verse I just quoted in Revelation 17:14, those who are with him, those who are with him are the called, the chosen, and the faithful. Revelation 22:15 talks about those whoever loves and practices a lie. About a month ago or so, I talked about the way of truth versus the way of error. There's a reason I did that lesson, so then I have to spend a whole lot of time talking about it in this class. But that is one of the things that the book of Revelation does for me, is it draws a line in the sand and says that there are those who are with Christ, and then there's everybody else. And so it's important on our parts to make sure to test ourselves whether or not we are in the faith. as Peter said in 2 Peter 3:16, that there are those who are able who twist the scriptures to their own destruction. A false way, as I pointed out a couple months ago, is the way of death. That's how Satan murders. According to John 8:44, he was a lie, the father of lies from the beginning, and a murderer. And the way Satan kills people is to kill their souls by committing them to a false way. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus, is what Revelation points out to us. Those who endure are those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus Christ. Also, it is a book of comfort. And there's a lot of ways that the Lord comforts His people. In 1 Thessalonians 4:13, a passage that we'll go to later on in this study, Paul says, "I do not want you to be ignorant." Now, you've probably heard the expression, ignorance is bliss, but that's never been my philosophy. I like to know stuff. And God likes His people to know stuff. He wants us to be wise in His ways. He wants us to be simple concerning evil and knowledgeable about His will for us. Paul did not want the Thessalonians to be ignorant concerning the day of the Lord and those who had fallen asleep. When he wrote them again, he wrote in 2 Thessalonians 2:2 that he did not want them to be shaken in mind or troubled. It does seem to me, and we'll come back to this, that the apostles probably knew quite a bit about what was going to unfold in the book of Revelation. They seemed to know about the falling away or the great apostasy, if you will. And it doesn't seem that they kept that secret from the people that they taught, their brethren. I would imagine that they were quite open about the falling away and the man of sin or the son of perdition. So I don't think these were necessarily hidden doctrines, but the way that it was going to unfold is the revelation itself, as the first chapter of the book makes clear. That it was at this point in time and history that Jesus Christ, God, through Jesus Christ, decided to let this information be known to the churches. And one of the points of the book of Revelation, last chapter, is John is told not to seal this prophecy. You may recall in the last chapter of Daniel that particular vision, part of the vision, was to be sealed until the time of the end. And I think Revelation is the answer to that sealing there. And as I'm going to go ahead and give my crack at the 1290 and the 1335 in this study from Daniel 13 as well. So it's a book of comfort because it lets us know things that Jesus is the Lord of Lords and King of Kings, the ruler of all the kings of the earth, and that He is going to make them His footstool one day. He's going to conquer all of His enemies, and His people will be saved so long as they persevere with Him. In Isaiah 41 and 2, the prophet spoke comfort. "Yes, comfort my people, says your God. Speak comfort to Jerusalem and cry out to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned." This is a constant process with God, is that His revelations, His words, His oracles are often words of warning, but also words of comfort to His people. There's a passage I'm going to have Jeff read, the 46th Psalm. I'll give my voice a rest here for a moment. And it's a passage that always comes to mind when I think of the book of Revelation. So, Jeff, could you go ahead and read that for us?
Psalm 46. "God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, even though the earth be removed and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though its waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling. There is a river whose stream shall make glad the city of God, a holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her just at the break of dawn. The nations raged, the kingdoms were moved. He uttered His voice. The earth melted. The Lord of hosts is with us. God of Jacob is our refuge. Come, behold the works of the Lord, who has made desolation in the earth. He makes war cease to the end of the earth. bow and cuts the spear in two. He burns the chariot in the fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge.
Thank you, Jeff. I can't say anything better than that, but that is a passage that always comes to mind when I read the book of Revelation. And that's one of the things that comforts me, is that God is our refuge, that no matter what the nations are plotting, it's all in vain, because God is going to overcome. What is the revelation? The revelation, the word that we have, comes from the Greek apokalypsis. It means to uncover, to unveil, to bring to light. In this case, Jesus is revealing things to John, and they are things that he says in his own words must shortly take place. And that's repeated essentially in Revelation 22:6, that these things are about to take place, or they're about to start taking place. It is also, we're told, a prophecy, prophetia, from the compound word from the Greek pro and phema. Pro means before, and basically it means to clarify beforehand, to forthtell or foretell. And this was used widely among the church as to describe the inspiration that the individual prophets receive from God. And these could come in various ways, as we learned in the book of Hebrews. And in 1 Peter, we're told that Jesus Christ himself is the spirit of prophecy. So it makes sense that Jesus is the one actually doing the revealing here. And as the book of Revelation is structured, what we see is it's a series or sequence of visions. Now, what makes this different from like Zechariah and Daniel is that John did receive all of this on one Lord's Day. As chapter 1 tells us, he was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day, and these things started to happen, or he started to see these things. And as I understand it, the fact that it is a series or sequence, it's in chronological order, and we'll talk more about that in the coming weeks. How is Revelation structured? The most obvious is to see it as a prologue with three series of sevens. We have seven seals, seven trumpets, and seven bowls. There is what I call a parenthetical set of visions, which gives us a history of the little horn of Daniel, or the man of sin of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, and that's actually where we're going to spend the plurality of our time once we get there. Another way that I see it, and I meant to point this out in the class I taught on Isaiah a year or so ago, is it's actually structured kind of similarly to the book of Isaiah. You may remember chapters 1 through 5, God basically is reminding the Israelites that he can see everything about them. He knows what they're doing. He knows how they're living. He can see everything about them. Essentially, he's saying, I know your works, just as Jesus is describing to the churches in chapters 1 through 3, letters that we went through last summer. Then in chapter 6, we have a throne vision of God sitting on a throne where the song is sung, Holy, Holy, Holy. In chapter 4, we have a very similar scene with God enthroned, and they're singing a similar song, Holy, Holy, Holy. And basically, both books from that point answer two questions. What of our enemies? And up through chapter 39 of the book of Isaiah, the bulk of that section of the book is answering the question, what about our enemies? And it goes through the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Philistines and the Moabites, and we talked about that in that class. And then the second part that they want to know is, what about your people? And that's exactly what the book of Revelation is about. What about our enemies? In this case, Rome is the enemy. And what of your people? Now, there are some contrasts that are kind of interesting. When Isaiah in chapter 6 witnesses the throne and the one who sat on it, the Ancient of Days, he comes undone. And he says, woe is me, I am undone, for I'm a man of unclean lips. And he's not worthy, in his opinion, and he's right, to speak the oracles of God to his people. And so there's a vision there where the coal is touched to his lips and he's made clean. That's different than what we see in chapter 5 of Revelation, where Christ, they sing, worthy is the Lamb. You may recall that John is shown the vision of the scroll, and then he weeps because there's no one found worthy to open it. And then they say, well, wait a second. And he sees the Lamb who is worthy to loose the scrolls and begin to make this revelation to his people. So there are some contrasts there that are quite interesting. But what it does is it does elevate Christ as we see him in the first chapter of the book of Revelation. Its place in history. I guess a couple things I will mention real quickly before I go to its place in history is Zechariah is also similar in some ways as much as Daniel is, in that in my interpretation of Zechariah, it's also a chronological series of visions, according to my interpretation. And that's the same with Revelation, a chronological historical sequence. Another thing I'll point out is Matthew 24, verse 3. You remember Jesus and his apostles are going around Jerusalem and they're showing him the buildings of the temple precinct and how marvelous these things are. And Jesus told them that all of these stones would be tossed down. And then they ask him in verse 3, tell us, when will these things be and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? A couple of things I'll just point out about this really, really quickly. One, it seems to me that at that point, his apostles, and I think in the version in Luke, we learn that it's Peter, James, and John specifically. But it seems that they disconnect that Jesus is coming and the end of the age, in my opinion. But they are asking at least a twofold question, as the case may be. When will these things be? In other words, when will the temple be destroyed? And what will be the sign of your coming? And perhaps the end of the age is a third question. You'll notice in each of the versions, what Jesus does first before answering them is what? He gives them a summary of what they're going to be about, what their real business is. That they'll be preaching and teaching, that they'll be dragged before magistrates, and they'll be persecuted in many, many ways. And he's letting them know that that's the important thing, is that your work, and there's always been an immediacy in the things that God wants us to do on his behalf, to always assume that the next moment is the last moment. So work like that's the case and worry about things in their time and place. But then he does go ahead and answer their question. And that's kind of what the book of Revelation is to me. We have the whole New Testament telling us probably the most important stuff. But then he does give us the book of Revelation in the time and place when it was most needful. And I think that's the important thing to keep in mind, is that God gives us what we need when we need it. And apparently it was decided that these seven churches in Asia, they needed it at this point in time because of the persecutions they were facing. And also because I believe John was probably in his 90s and was about to pass on anyway. So, Revelation's place in history. Irenaeus, excuse me, Irenaeus was a disciple, I guess, or a student of Polycarp, who was a student of John. So you have this direct link going back some time. He was from about 180 A.D. And he wrote that the revelation or the apocalypse, quote, was seen not very long ago, almost in our own generation, at the close of the reign of Domitian. And that was in his Against Heresies. The testimony of Irenaeus, not far removed from the apostolic age, is first rate. And not only that, it's the only actual historical notice we have as to a specific date, that it was at the close of the reign of Domitian. Domitian died in 96 A.D., and that's when I think probably this revelation was seen by John. So Irenaeus places the book near the end of that reign, and Irenaeus seems to be unaware of any other view for the date of the book of Revelation. Another testimony comes from Clement of Alexandria. He lived from about 155 to 215. He says that John returned from the Isle of Patmos, which is mentioned in the first chapter, after the tyrant was dead. Now, he does not name who the tyrant was, but considering that Domitian was the second persecutor of the church after Nero, it seems putting two and two together, it just makes sense. And also Eusebius, who is known as the father of church history, does identify the tyrant as Domitian. And most scholars seem to agree with that. Victorinus was a writer in the late 200s A.D. He was the author of the earliest known commentary of the book of Revelation. And what he said was this: when John said these things, he was in the island of Patmos, condemned to the mines by Caesar Domitian. There he saw the apocalypse, and when at length grown old, he thought that he should receive his release by suffering. But Domitian being killed, he was liberated. And they go to say that John went ahead and lived out his last days at Ephesus from that point. Jerome, AD 340 to 420, said, "In the 14th then after Nero, Domitian, having raised up a second persecution, he was banished to the island of Patmos and wrote the Apocalypse." So to all of this may be added the comment of Eusebius, who contends that the historical tradition of his time, and he wrote around 324, 325 AD, placed the writing of the Apocalypse at the close of Domitian's reign in 96 AD. And no serious scholar really disputes that. The only disputes are what the book concerns, really, in my estimation. But let's consider some other things internal to the book. Let's consider, for example, Ephesus. Spiritual conditions of the churches described in the first couple chapters more readily harmonize with a date in the 90s. Ephesus, for instance, was not founded by Paul until the latter part of Claudius's reign. And when he wrote to them from Rome in AD 61, give or take, instead of reproving them for any want of love, he commends them for their love and faith. Yet when Revelation was written, in spite of the fact that the Ephesians had been patient, according to chapter 2, verse 2, they had also abandoned their first love, verse 4, and this would seem to require a greater length of time than just a handful of years, something on the order of 35 years. Seems more likely and reasonable. So the later date there would seem the better choice. Another piece of evidence for the late date is that the book was penned while John was banished to the Isle of Patmos in Revelation 1:9. Now, it's well known that Domitian was fond of this type of persecution. He would often banish people, and a lot of times they would be banished to islands in the Mediterranean. So if, however, this persecution is dated to the time of Nero, as some would like to do, how does one account for the fact that Peter and Paul were killed during that persecution? And almost all scholars agree that Nero's persecution of Christians was confined to the environs of Rome itself and didn't spread outside the city. Along those lines, we have Laodicea. The church at Laodicea is represented as existing under conditions of great wealth. She was rich and had need of nothing. And that's speaking of the church there in Revelation 3:17. In AD 60 or thereabouts, Laodicea was almost entirely destroyed by an earthquake. So the conditions described of the city in the book of Revelation chapter 3 would seem to match a city that had had enough time to recover from a devastating earthquake. Another piece of evidence, the Nicolaitans, the doctrinal departures described in Revelation would appear to better fit a later dating as well. For example, the Nicolaitans in 2:6 and 15 were a full-fledged sect at the time of John's writings, whereas they had perhaps only been hinted at in very general terms in 2 Peter and the book of Jude, which were probably written in the mid-60s A.D. And just one last piece, we have Antipas at Pergamos. The persecution for professing Christians, for professing the Christian faith, is evidenced in those early letters to the seven churches of Asia Minor. For instance, Antipas had been killed in Pergamon. It is generally agreed among scholars, however, like I said earlier, that Nero's persecution was mostly confined to Rome, if not entirely. So, and also, it was not for religious reasons that Nero persecuted the Christians. But in the case of Domitian, it was. As far as I know, Domitian was the first Roman emperor to persecute Christians because they would not worship him and the so-called imperial cult. So those are pieces of external and internal evidence that I think strongly support a date for the Revelation in the 90s AD. And I'll just go quickly through some arguments against the authorship and the date. Some have noted a supposed difference in style between John's Gospels/letters and the book of Revelation. I am not a Greek scholar, so I can only go by what others have read or what others have written about that. A didn't mean to push that. But I'll just throw out a couple things here. One, it's been noted that archaeological discoveries and literary studies have recently demonstrated that along with Aramaic and Hebrew, Greek was commonly spoken among first century Palestinians. So John probably knew Greek from his youth. Greek had been spoken in the area of Judea since the time of Alexander. Secondly, the revelation betrays no lack of knowledge or command of the Greek language in syntax or vocabulary. The difference does lie rather in the manner in which the language is used. And this can be because it's using Hebrew symbols and idiom in the Greek language. And so it might not, in other words, it might not flow as well as, say, the Gospel of John, which most people say is an extremely well-written Greek book, or the letters of John. So that may be one way that the grammatical peculiarities. Also, there's no mention of Jerusalem's destruction. It's claimed that Revelation must have been penned shortly before or after the destruction of Jerusalem, since it has no allusion to the destruction of Jerusalem, as if the book should. If Jerusalem has already been destroyed, then it should have made a mention of that. However, one thing I'll point out is, first of all, if John wrote this near 96 AD, a quarter century after the destruction, there would be little need to focus on the destruction of Jerusalem since it would have been such a well-known event. I'm going to point this out later, but the Roman military record of the first century is kind of hit and miss. They suffered a lot of major losses. Germany was kind of their Vietnam. They lost three legions there in the time of Octavian. As it turns, they had really a lot of trouble with the Dacians in Southeast Europe. Jerusalem, the conquest of Jerusalem was the most significant conquest for the Roman Empire in the entire first century. So when you look at the Arch of Titus in Rome, which still exists, they were extremely excited about it because it was one thing that they could finally hang their hat on. They were also trying to conquer Britain, a process that took them three invasions over about an 80-year period. So they had a lot of trouble militarily during the first century. Jerusalem was the one thing that they could kind of hang their hat on. So it was a widely known event, widely advertised. Everybody knew about it. So John having to address the destruction of Jerusalem 25 years later doesn't seem to hold much weight to it. Secondly, the contention that the literal city and temple were still standing based upon chapter 11 ignores the express symbolic nature of the narrative. And we're, of course, going to look at that more closely. There is a temple in the 11th chapter of Revelation, but since the whole book is written in symbols, we'll of course talk about that. Last thing I'll mention along these lines, I'll mention one more thing. We were just in Matthew chapter 24. Jesus dealt very well with the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. So there were other Old Testament prophets that did the same. So there wasn't any need for John to rehash it. Also, Nero has tried to be associated with the number 666, which does appear in the book of Revelation. And they would 1318, as a matter of fact. They see this as a reference to Nero. In fact, it is the academic opinion that Nero is the one spoken of here in Revelation 1318. That's because they will not allow for anything supernatural. But as I was looking into this, there's some interesting things. One, they add Caesar to Nero's name, which isn't necessary, to compute the letter number arrangement on the basis of Hebrew, whereas the book was written in Greek. And after the spelling of Caesar, they had to drop a letter in the Hebrew to make it even sort of work. So all this really reveals is kind of a desperate attempt to make the number 666 a reference to Nero when it's actually not. There's a lot more information on that we could go over, but I don't think we will. Revelation's place in the canon. There's a lot of information here that we could go through, and we'll kind of touch on a lot of this later. But its early reception among the churches was outstanding. It was readily received. All of them accepted it as coming from John. And that's the way it was for the first century or so. The objections to the revelation were later, and they were limited, and the people that objected to them had theological, doctrinal issues with it. For instance, some of them had millennial beliefs, some of the earliest millennial beliefs, and we'll talk about that later. But the objections to revelation were not driven by historical matters. And lastly, all of these objections were eventually resolved, and the book was generally received as being canonical by the fourth century. So it kind of went through it at an interesting history where it was readily received, then it was disputed and rejected by some, and then eventually came back to be considered one of the received books. Next week, we're going to try to look at Old Testament symbols and numbers, begin a history of the interpretation of Revelation. And that is my email address. If you have any questions or anything you want me to address as the weeks progress, I'll probably put that at the end of every presentation so you can have that information. Thank you.